This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour, our week in review program. If you are a regular listener, it seems you and I have something in common. I genuinely enjoy this show. Each week, we get our panel of trumpet writers together to discuss important events of the week, and I always learn quite a bit. These men put a lot of work to follow events and trends around the world and to analyze them according to how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. I believe they do a stellar job. I also want to take a moment to say I hope you're listening to the other offerings on Trumpet Radio. I've heard a number of programs from this past week, and they really offer high-quality information on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Stephen Fleury did an outstanding job this week. I really enjoyed his program in particular on Wednesday, talking about the incredibly timid U.S. response to Iran's violations of the nuclear deal by test-firing ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads. He does an excellent job of parsing out these statements from U.S. officials and helping us to recognize the real weakness of America's will. Jeremiah Jacques' program, The Sun Also Rises, this week tells a gripping Cold War era story of an incident that almost started global thermonuclear war and a lesson that we can take from that. I was driving home last night and heard that on the radio, and I got home and I sat in my garage for about 10 minutes because I had to stay right to the end of that program. Dennis Leap's Just the Best Literature had a panel of readers 60 years and older this week talking about the old man in the sea. How cool is that? So anyway, let's get to the news and our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Robert Morley.
Good to be here. I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of Warren Buffett. Well, this week, Charlie Munger, who is his right-hand man, been with him from the beginning, some of the most successful investors in the world, gave a pretty dark warning about America's financial situation. He called it a casino. So today we'll talk about why he's warning it will end in disaster.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Great to be on the show. Today we'll be talking about Russian jets harassing U.S. ships in the Baltic Sea and China and India's relationship in outer space.
We also have via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. France wants a European army, and Germany is building one out of a multinational panzer division. That's what we'll be discussing in Europe today.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello, everybody. I'll be talking about a deal that was struck between the Egyptians and the Saudis over the weekend, and we'll talk about the ramifications of that and why a lot of the Egyptian public are up in arms.
Well, we're going to start the show by talking about Vladimir Putin. This man is doing some extraordinary things in Russia. He's turned a country that a lot of people want to dismiss as irrelevant into one of the most unpredictable and aggressive nations on earth. He's done a lot to cement his own power. He's been leading Russia since 1999, 17 years this coming August. And he still enjoys public approval ratings in the 80% range. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief has drawn a lot of attention to this man and some biblical prophecies that he appears to be fulfilling. He recently made a provocative move that made his grip on power even more formidable. And to tell us about that, we will turn to Andrew.
Yes, well, last week, Vladimir Putin just really completely revolutionized Russian law enforcement. And before we get into the details, there's an important concept you have to understand about Russian law enforcement. It's a very different system than we've had here in the United States, in that they have, similar to the United States, they do have a military that deals with, supposed to deal with external threats, but their domestic police force has always been centralized. They don't have like the local sheriffs and state police and county constables like we have here. It's the police force in Russia is run by the Ministry of Internal Affairs. But what Putin changed last week is he's actually announced the creation of a new police force separate from the Department of Internal Affairs that will report directly to his personal bodyguard, or a man who was his personal bodyguard. He's now going to be called the Minister of the National Guard. So this is a new domestic army, basically, but going to be about 400,000 strong, tasked with putting down riots or any sort of civil unrest that reports directly to Vladimir Putin.
So this isn't a new concept. This actually is something that has pretty lengthy historical precedence. Maybe you could tell us about that a little bit.
Right, not a new concept at all. It's been around since the idea of a dictator or a strong man having his own private army has been around since ancient times. Probably the most famous example, which a lot of news analysts are bringing out with Putin's recent move, is the Praetorian Guard. This was like the bodyguard force of the Roman Emperor. It was made permanent by Emperor Caesar Augustus. And it was this force that, separate from the Roman legions, that just owed allegiance directly to the emperor and was used to put down any threats against him personally. And Napoleon, Peter the Great, even some of the Soviet leaders had similar forces. And that really seems to be almost kind of the template that Putin's using in putting together this force.
So where does he plan to get these forces from? These are basically redirecting the chain of command from existing forces?
Right. I mean, to start out, it's going to take it from the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Now, they, like I said before, they run all law enforcement in Russia, but they had a special force in that ministry, about 170,000 strong, that was specifically designed to take down, quell civil unrest, not just like routine speeding ticket arrest or anything like that, but for like civil unrest, this force was trained for that. So he's taking that force, putting it under the command of his former bodyguard, and then supplementing it with other military special forces and police forces to about double its number, up to about between 350,000 and 400,000 people.
This is a big, big force.
Right. It's actually it's about four times the size of the British military. So, I mean, that's some good bragging rights for Putin there. If Britain gets up and he can be like, my bodyguard's four times the size of your military. But
so what are some details that he's given about the job description that this force is going to have?
Right. As he puts this together, I mean, when he announced it, he said it's especially for like countering terrorist threats, organized crime, drug trafficking, and then any sort of anti-riot civil threats. The other aspect that's really makes it quite unique is he's also giving it the authority to issue all firearms license in Russia. Again, unlike United States, Russia, they don't have their own Second Amendment. I mean, no one has a right to own a gun. You have to apply for the government for that right. And so everyone from hunters to self-defense will have to go through this new National Guard for firearm licenses.
So maybe you could give us some details or some idea of what it is about what Putin has done here that was so surprising and that has really given his critics, raised real alarm bells in their minds.
Right. Well, I mean, Russian government to begin with is very hierarchical. So even the military and the Ministry of Internal Affairs do report to Putin. So it's not that he's necessarily created a bunch more troops that he didn't have before. He's just reorganized them into a very elite force that's reporting to a man who was his personal bodyguard. And so a lot of analysis are saying that he may be getting kind of skeptical of even the loyalty of some of his cabinet members, because this really does weaken the Ministry of Internal Affairs quite a bit. And the man who runs that ministry, he has good relations with Putin, but he's not considered part of his inner circle. But by taking forces from that group and then putting it under a new National Guard run by his bodyguard, he's really made the point that it's like, these troops are loyal to me. And even the military and the police and the other departments in Russia need to know that I have my own personal army to make sure that there's no threats against my regime. Which is unique, considering that, I mean, technically he's supposed to be up for elections again in 2 years, that he's so concerned about holding on to power when the Russian people are supposed to be having a say.
Right.
And not very long about who is their next leader.
Andrew actually has an article about this on the Trumpet site today called New Praetorian Guard, quote unquote, seals Putin's hold on power. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. The last paragraph of that story: as President Putin is combining Stalin's idea of a unitary state model with imperial policies from Russia's czarist era, like the Byzantine empires and Russian czars, Putin is using the Russian Orthodox Church as a de facto state religion to unify his empire. We talked about that last week. If this Orthodox-dominated unitary state isn't enough to secure his power base, Putin now has a 400,000-strong Praetorian Guard to do his bidding. Thanks for that story, Andrew. One of the areas that Putin has made significant inroads into is Ukraine, this battleground of sorts between Europe and Asia. And Ukraine is in a lot of trouble. This past Tuesday, the nation's prime minister announced he is resigning. The entire Ukrainian government is mired in corruption scandals. There's a lot of discontent among Ukrainians. To tell us about what this means and why it's important, we're going to go to Richard in the UK.
Yes, as you said, there's a lot of building discontent within Ukraine at the current government. You had a few months ago some very prominent anti-corruption officials resign and said, you know, corruption is so endemic in this government, we can't do our job, there's no point us staying here. The rolling fallout of that led to the resignation of the prime minister this week and of the government. Then separate to that, you had the Panama Papers implicated very strongly the president, Petro Poroshenko, in corruption. So the entire leadership class, the executive, the government, the parliament, they're all mired in this widespread perception of corruption. And then even before the Panama Papers were released, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, she warned that there's a real risk that Ukraine will begin to, quote, slide backwards once again into corruption, into lawlessness, into vassal statehood. And then while this is going on, Ukraine has major, major problems with its economy. There's a lot of discontent within the army. They don't feel that, and the army and also militant groups that are kind of part of the army, they don't feel they've been properly supported by the Ukrainian central government. So a lot of discontent building in Ukraine.
It was just 2.5 years ago, right? The Ukrainians ousted a Russian-backed oligarch. And now we're just a little ways down the track, and they're really upset at a Western-backed leader. So they're swinging this pendulum back and forth. And where is this going to end up?
Well, first, there's just the disruption that another outbreak of kind of a revolution would bring in Ukraine. So we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly from Foreign Policy called "The Toxic Coddling of Petro Poroshenko." And Lev Golikin, he writes that Ukraine is turning into a 45 million person Texas-sized pressure cooker in the middle of Europe. And he talks about the growing pressure there, and he says sooner or later, Poroshenko or someone in his circle will do something so unforgivable and outrageous that it will ignite another rage of protests. The difference between Ukraine in 2013 and 2016, however, is in 2 years of war, nearly 10,000 casualties and over 2 million refugees and internally displaced persons. Ukraine is flooded with weapons, has a hostile population in the southeastern region, a disillusioned military, an economy fresh from teetering on the brink of collapse, and most importantly, heavy armed battalions of far-right fighters. Another uprising is likely to push the country towards disintegration. So if there is another uprising, there's this huge potential for chaos on the border of Europe, which, whatever happens after that uprising, just that uprising alone is going to put a lot of pressure on Europe. But then if you think back on Ukraine's recent history, where they had the Orange Revolution in the early 2000s, where a pro-Western government came to power, and then the revolutionaries fractured, Russia was able to get back in there, they were able to get their man back in charge, and they were able to bring Ukraine back under their control. Now, this time around, doing something like that would be much harder. By invading Crimea and Western Ukraine, that whole region is much more anti-Russian than they used to be. But all that discontent within the current leadership, that could give Putin an opening to reverse that pro-Western direction that we've seen in Ukraine.
Well, this will definitely be an area that we need to watch closely. The tug of war between Russia and Europe really is nowhere more hot than it is in Ukraine. Andrew, you had a comment.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of anecdotal, but Putin had held a press conference, as he does every year, for anyone can send in any questions he wants, they want. And there's like 12-year-old Russian girl asked him. She said, so if you'd seen Ukrainian Prime Minister Poroshenko or Turkish President Erdogan drowning, and they're both, which would you say first? Which, and they're both, Putin doesn't like either of them. So that was his answer. He said, well, he said, if either of those guys to choose to drown, said, I don't think anyone's going to be able to save him anyway.
Well, we appreciate you bringing that story to our attention. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to turn now to a story out of the Middle East, some very interesting developments happening in Egypt. This is a nation we keep a close eye on for a number of reasons, and the government there is facing a lot of heat lately. A development this week only made things more difficult. For this story, we're going to turn to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, King Salman of Saudi Arabia, I'd like to start with him, actually, because he was the one that kind of got the ball rolling for the deal that was worked out between Egypt and the Saudis. He was in Egypt earlier this week or over the weekend, and we've really watched Egypt under Sisi, their president, and Saudi Arabia become a whole lot closer over the past year, especially working together in Yemen to fight against Iranian influence there. And ever since the Russians have kind of got their people, their tourists out of Egypt, and when that plane went down coming out of Sharm el Sheikh, the tourism's really taken a dive in Egypt. A lot of money is being not made, and it's really affecting the people there, and it's really affecting the tenuous leadership of el-Sisi. So what happened this week is Saudi Arabia was there, King Salman again, he was there, and there was a number of business deals that were worked out between the two nations. But the big thing that got people really upset, especially in Egypt, was an agreement to transfer the sovereignty of two islands at the southeastern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. These two islands, Sanafir and Tiran, they're right at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba, on the Red Sea, that goes down towards the southern tip of Israel. Extremely strategic islands. They're uninhabited, but they've played a role in wars past. And these two islands were given up by el-Sisi and handed over to the Saudis, who are on the other side of the Gulf. And this resulted in quite a large outcry from the public on social media, how they disagreed with this action, how Sisi was shown as giving up everything he could, to the point of giving up land to try and get more deals or more money from the Saudis. And there was even many different tweets that were put out. One critic, quite a popular critic of Sisi, an Egyptian, he tweeted $1 billion for an island, $2 billion for a pyramid, and we'll throw in some statues for free. And that went, viral, I guess, if you can do that on Twitter. A lot of people retweeting that. And initially, it was when I saw what was happening about this and the news reports that were coming out, I didn't think it would amount to too much, but it just hasn't died down. I wrote an article about this 2 days ago, just this deal and the outpouring on social media. And then I just updated it before I got on the program with some footage of protests today in Egypt. And just the vehemence of the public for what basically doesn't amount to much, a couple of uninhabited islands given over to the Saudis. You know, there were territorial claims by the Saudis for these islands initially, so it's not like they were probably totally Egyptian. But there's some real anger out there against the leadership of Sisi because of this.
Well, you wouldn't view this in isolation, would you? It seems like Sisi has made a lot of enemies among the Egyptian population for a lot of reasons. I guess this raises two questions in my mind. What is it about this? I guess this seems like straw that broke the camel's back type of response, but also what is it about those islands that the Egyptians are so attached to, or they're so opposed to making these kinds of concessions to the Saudis?
Right. I don't think Egyptians have that much of an attachment to these islands. I doubt they've heard about these islands in the past you know, 15, 20 years. They haven't been, you know, on the geopolitical map for the Egyptian public. While the Israelis probably know about these islands, I'm sure, the Egyptians haven't really been too concerned with them. What we're seeing is just probably about 2 years worth of anger against El-Sisi. And like you say, this is probably the straw, or might be the straw, that breaks the camel's back. Ever since the Islamic Revolution was there, Morsi came into power because of a similar, his rise to power and what took down Mubarak started on social media back then. People came out and protest over grievances, historical grievances, long-standing grievances, especially right. by the Muslim Brotherhood.
You can't help but look at what's happening right now as some kind of a deja vu situation.
Right, and we wouldn't be the only people to say that as well. We are looking for another revolution inside Egypt to maybe turn over the rulership of El-Sisi, since he is so pro-West and pro-Saudi Arabia and even moving towards Turkey and so anti-Iran. So we're looking for a revolution, but I'm not the only one saying that this is, like, it looks like the starting of another revolution. I mean, the fact is, yesterday Sisi was so worried that protests were going to break out over this that he put out a memorandum to the public saying that there have been no permissions granted for lawful protest tomorrow, and people are going to be arrested if they do. And the Muslim Brotherhood apparently put out leaflets to protest, and sure enough, people come out of Friday prayers, as is normally the case, except this time they start protesting all over. And you can check out that I've just got a 15-second clip of some pretty angry people that are protesting over this, knowing full well that they could be arrested by a regime that has got no qualms about putting down public dissent, putting you in prison for public dissent. The same things Mubarak was famous for before he got ousted.
Right. So you can't help but see some parallels here, with Mubarak being more of a strongman type leader who really did keep a lid on some of the more extremist elements within Egyptian society. As soon as he's taken out of the picture, Mohamed Morsi rises up heavily. Muslim Brotherhood, more extreme in his views, Islamist sympathizing type of leader. And then Sisi comes into power much more, I guess, in the sense that he's very much put a check on that extremism, somewhat in the mold of Mubarak. What's going to happen after he leaves? And we have another article in the Trumpet Weekly this week about Western media calls to end U.S.-Egypt alliance. That's from Trumpet writer Callum Wood. And the New York Times and other places basically saying, we need to get this guy out of here. The time has passed for him to be gone. Same kind of language that you saw in the Mubarak era.
Exactly the same.
So it will be interesting to see how this unfolds. We didn't get a chance to, we're out of time for this segment, but the effect that this could even have on Israel will be interesting to watch, because of the strength of that Egyptian-Israeli alliance has really been a pillar of Middle East stability for so long. And with the giving up of those islands, it seems like even that is in jeopardy as well. Well, we appreciate you bringing that story to our attention, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll have one more story before the break. Some news came out this week from a warning from an investment giant that really should be of concern to all of us. For this, we'll go to Robert Morley.
Yes, as you said, Charlie Munger, he's Warren Buffett's right-hand man. Those of you who are maybe unfamiliar with Warren Buffett, he runs Berkshire Hathaway, which has been one of the most successful investment funds in U.S. history. And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have been with this fund from its very, very beginning. And this week, Business Insider had a piece talking about a message that Charlie Munger gave at a conference. And they described it this way. They said, Warren Buffett's right-hand man gave a dark warning about American finance. And what he was warning about is this new culture that he sees in American finance. And he calls it a casino culture. In this talk that he gave, he went on to say that America has developed, quote, a vast gambling culture, and people have made it respectable. And what he's talking about is the U.S. stock markets, Wall Street, the big banks. And he's saying that there was a time in American history when the respectable thing to do was to go out, build a business, build an industry, build a product that people wanted and needed, and to build wealth that way. And in that respect, as you built wealth, you built the prosperity of the nation, you helped improve living standards, all these kind of things that help bring prosperity to America. And he's looking at America today and America industry today, and he asks the question, well, what is our most important industry today? Well, it's not manufacturing anymore. It's not all these things. It's Wall Street. And he's saying how much of Wall Street is actually adding a benefit. So in the speech, he kind of rails on two things. On you can see the undertones against Wall Street, but also against this mentality of the stock market. And he's saying that, you know, there's all these people that are out there getting rich. And he's saying, you know, how are they doing it? By buying pieces of paper. I mean, that's all they're doing is they're buying little pieces of paper.
Or pushing digits around on a computer screen.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. We're shuffling little digits around. We're picking out stocks we're going to invest in. And all you do is you hope you're a better picker than somebody else. Mm-hmm. And you hope that, you know, you're a little more proficient at buying a piece of paper than somebody else. And he says, how does this do anything to, you know, actually better the nation, to better the country? And he's saying that, well, he made some pretty interesting comparisons, I thought. He went on and talked about, he compared it to time periods in you know, history, like the Edwardian age, King Edward of England, even before World War I. He said there were time periods in England's history where 300 people owned half the land of England. And he said, what did those people do with it? And he said, well, at that time period, a lot of these people who were rich and just inherited their money, they went to the gambling dens, the gambling halls, and they'd sit around gambling all day with their money, doing nothing productive. And he's saying we're kind of in the same sorts of situation now.
Richard, you had a comment.
Yeah, the other part of this is look at who is being attracted to those kind of careers in Wall Street that aren't really accomplishing much. A lot of it is physics PhDs, mathematics PhDs, you know, people who are really, really valuable. The type of people that if America is going to maintain its technological edge really need working on cutting edge science, working on cutting edge technology, on engineering. So these are some of the smartest, the most talented people in the country. And they're being attracted to this industry that, as Rob said, isn't actually producing anything. And they've been diverted from being some of the most productive to being some of the least productive.
Listening to this guy's comments, it sounds like a guy who's kind of going through a midlife crisis here and evaluating himself. He says, I'm actually part of the problem here. So what's the solution in his view?
Well, he doesn't have a solution. I think when he was talking about it, he actually came out and said, you know, this is something that it's going to be very hard to do anything about. And as Richard's brought out, I mean, where is the money today in America? Well, it's on Wall Street. And so, like Richard said, instead of physicists going out there and solving engineering problems, they're figuring out how to build an algorithm or something that can trade stocks 1/1000th of a microsecond, you know, faster than the next guy, to just skim that extra penny or fraction of a penny off of billions of trades, you know, per second, doing nothing productive, but becoming these croupiers, he calls it, you know, the middleman, the casinos. So he doesn't see any easy solutions to this. But just to make his warning, I think, stand a little bit more, he says in this article, it's not often that I, a capitalist, someone who's made my money from free market capitalism, would be agreeing with people like
Bernie Sanders,
Elizabeth Warren, right? These people. And he said, but I have to, because they see a problem. Now, I don't agree with their solutions, but they see this problem. You know, the too big to fail banks that you know, the vast behemoths, and they cause these massive speculative bubbles. And he's saying, look, we're living in an economy now that's going from bubble to bubble to bust, and the bust is far worse than the bubbles. And we have to look at why these bubbles are happening. And he puts the blame squarely on this gambling culture that has taken over Wall Street.
Well, he talks about the fact that these people can't be expected to police themselves. They're kind of trapped within that system and are making money the way that the system has permitted them to do it. So he says the only way that we can put a check on this is through legislation. and regulation. So in other words, the government has to step in. So he may say that he doesn't agree with the Bernie Sanders of the world, but in a sense, he is advocating more government power and control over this kind of activity in order to keep a check on it. And that comes with problems of its own.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right about that. It does come with problems of its own. Look at the last crisis. We had all these regulators who were supposed to be in charge of these things, supposed to be watching over. And, you know, famously Ben Bernanke, how many times in the lead up to the last bus said, you know, there's no bubble. I don't see any problem here. Everything's contained, et cetera, et cetera. So we do have a system where we end up giving more power to the bureaucrats. And it doesn't accomplish anything. But here's the take-home message from this. I think, and this is probably the key to what he was saying, the thing that we need to pay most attention to, people need to pay most attention to, and it's just, he's looking at the future. He's saying, look, if this continues, where is it going to lead? Where does it lead? And he goes back to history, and he says, look, we saw conditions like this before. We've seen it in many countries before. And he's saying, look what happened to Germany in the lead-up to World War II. You know, it went through these time periods of inflation, terrible wealth-destroying inflation. Then it went through, you know, the solutions to that. And then it just went through to, and then it resulted in, you know, the economic depression that swept the world. All these things were the result of basically the financialization, the gambling culture that, you know, in the roaring 20s basically took over and became so prominent. And he's saying that led people to become depressed. That led people to lose hope. And it opened them up to being exploited by radicals. And he said, you know, the rise of Hitler was enabled by these kind of economic conditions that are coming again because of what's going on Wall Street today.
Yep. And in a sense, you can already see that. Just the fact that people are willing to put more hope in the hands of politicians and bureaucrats and giving up liberty for the sake of what they perceive as security. So in a sense, we do see that happening to some degree already in the United States. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a provocative act by a Russian jet, how Germany is taking over the Dutch army, President Obama's biggest regret, and two nations that are starting a new era of space cooperation. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. The Week in Review.
We started the show today by talking about Vladimir Putin's Russia. Here at the beginning of the second segment, we're going to revisit that nation. In the Baltic Sea, there was an extremely provocative act performed by a Russian jet. And to tell us about it, we will go to Andrew.
Yes, well, this happened Tuesday. There was a U.S. warship, the USS Donald Cook, was conducting joint flight operations with a Polish helicopter in the Baltic Sea when a Russian jet came out of seemingly nowhere, dove in as if in an attack pattern, and buzzed over the top of the ship just about 30 feet from the flight deck. And then I think circled around and did it at least one more time. The Navy released some footage of it the next day, and it's caused just a little bit of a media hubbubaloo on just how provocative this was. The U.S. press secretary's come out and saying White House press secretary talking about just how unprofessional and unsafe it is for Russia to do something like this. It almost makes it sound like it's an OSHA work violation or something like that. But it's
yeah. Stephen Fleury actually talked about this on his program yesterday, and the strongest language that the administration could muster was that this was inconsistent with professional norms.
Right, it's inconsistent. Like, he didn't have his steel-toed boots on while he was operating the forklift. This is unprofessional right. For this profession. But it's, right. But no, actually, I've got a quote here from this is from the Global Times, which is a Chinese newspaper, pretty well considered just to be a mouthpiece of the Chinese Communist Party, where they really make a big deal that the U.S. military was humiliated by its Russian counterpart. And I think the Chinese media has done really big mercy. They said, no, Russia's not. This isn't a workplace safety violation. This is Russia just being antagonistic and trying to show to the world that, yeah, we'll pretend like we're attacking your ships and then fly away and laugh. And, I mean, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, and who do you believe in a situation like this? There's really been a series of these kinds of incidents where the United States has bent over backwards to spin it as something that's just no big deal. You know, this is basically standard nautical procedure in the case of the Iranians taking U.S. sailors hostage, that type of thing. Or these other countries that, I mean, obviously they have something to gain from, Russia would have something to gain from propaganda perspective of really spinning this as something more than it is. But what about China?
Right. Well, and China is a very close ally of Russia and has their own tensions with the U.S. military. So I'm sure they're thrilled just to see anything that makes the U.S. military look bad. Actually, I think this type of thing was quite common in the Cold War between U.S. ships and Russia ships. We both did it to each other, just kind of in like a game of one-upmanship. And then eventually, I think there was some sort of agreement where they'd asked to stop for a while just because it was so humiliating. And so they, but any of those Cold War agreements fell apart with the fall of the Soviet Union. So it looks like the Russian military is just kind of trying to bring that antagonistic one-upmanship back to the global scene.
If you'd like more information about this, I would really recommend that you listen to Stephen Fleury's program from Thursday, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And he asks the question on that program, what would it take to actually upset America? The Russian jet have to actually bomb in order to provoke some kind of a response? Or is it just, it's basically whatever they want to do short of an actual attack, they are welcome to do? Certainly every time something like this happens, they do score a propaganda victory, if nothing else. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. One of the realities of Russia's rise is really something that is stirring Europe to recognize its need to be stronger militarily. And there were more interesting developments on this front over the past week. And to tell us about these, we're going to go back to our office in the UK and Richard Palmer.
Across Europe, people are realizing that they need to have a serious military power. One of the biggest indications of this week came in an interview that the French president, François Hollande, gave with the German tabloid The Bild, and he said, our two countries must agree to a budgetary effort on defense, i.e. spending more money on defense, and to act outside Europe, so having a military that goes into the Middle East and North Africa. Let's not rely on another power, even a friendly one, to do away with terrorism. And that's, I think, the clearest statement yet that we've had from a European leader, that we can't rely on America. We can't trust America to take care of this problem. We have got to do it ourselves. And this is a sentiment all across Europe. Donald Trump's statements about disbanding NATO, they've really touched a nerve. But it's not just Donald Trump. You know, President Obama has been making a lot of complaints about Europe not spending enough on its military. And so a lot of people now across Europe are starting to realize America doesn't really care that much about NATO anymore. Even if Trump doesn't get elected president, his sentiments are popular. You know, we can't rely on America having our back anymore. We need to up our game. We need to have a military power. We need to do a lot more. And we have a couple of articles from George Friedman that talk about that. And then he also makes the point that, you know, Europe and the United States, they're equal in wealth. Europe has more people than the United States. So there's no reason why they can't be as powerful a military as well.
Yeah, it's not difficult at all to see why they would be making this case, and you put it together with some of the other threats that are rising up in the world, the terrorism that Europe has been dealing with, the migrant crisis, Russia's aggression, and America's disappearance from the scene becomes that much more concerning and that much more of a pretense for stronger military action.
That's right. And then look who France is looking to now instead of America to help them with this initiative. They're looking to their fellow European power, Germany. And it's Germany that they're going to and saying, well, we need to spend more on defense. We need to do this. And, you know, Friedman points out that what a big change this will be for Germany, how they may well be reluctant to lead this major military power until they have an attack on their own soil. And that's true to a certain extent. But Germany is already working on a European army, and they're working harder than any other nation in Europe to bring this about in a very practical way. And we have another article on this subject in the Trumpet Weekly that is, you know, that's talking about the efforts that Germany are going to, the practical efforts to build this army. Now they've absorbed 2 out of the 3 Dutch combat battalions. They've been absorbed into the German army. They're not just, this isn't just an alliance. They're not just training together. They are actually part of the German army. They are in the German command structure. It's incredibly close cooperation. They're now expanding that to the naval sphere, where some 800 specialized German naval soldiers, they're going over to the Dutch army. The Germans are getting access to the Dutch, their biggest, their most expensive boat. That will allow the Germans now to greatly, dramatically expand their capability for landing on beaches, etc., and transporting and supporting troops. So you've got a very practical, concrete cooperation. And they've made clear over the past 3 or 4 years that the thinking behind this is all about aiming for something much bigger. The former defense minister, Thomas de Maizière, as he started kicking this off several years ago, he gave a speech where he basically outlined the case and said, it's taking too long to put together a European army. You know, we've talked and talked. We've had all these papers and conferences. Nothing actually happens. We're fed up with this. Let's stop talking, and we're going to roll up our sleeves and we'll get started. We'll work together with 1 or 2 nations. We'll work on having really deep cooperation with them. Then we'll invite a few more nations in bit by bit, and we'll create this core that we can build a European army around. And then a few years down the road, we will have this European army that we've talked so much about. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
Built from the ground up rather than from the top down.
Exactly. And now that they've got the Dutch in there, the Czechs are apparently really banging the doors down, saying we want a similar arrangement to the Dutch. Bring us in.
Well, weren't we talking about Poland last year?
Right. And Poland, they're experimenting with the same thing on the naval area. They've also swapped some smaller forces between the armies so they can start, get this process rolling. It starts to look at what the logistical challenges are going to be at, how compatible the different units are. So they've started the ball rolling with Poland. And then Ursula von der Leyen, the defense minister, has said that they plan to set up a multinational panzer division within the next year. So this is a division-sized force looking at 20,000 soldiers, a major, major force. And then the aim is that would be the nucleus of a European army. And what I think is very interesting about this, not just what they're doing, but also what does this say about Germany? You know, Friedman is right. The mass of German people, they do not want to be a major military power. But this method of creating a European army, of creating this multinational panzer division, inviting other nations to join, you know, is that the action of people who don't want to be a major military power, who don't want to lead a major military power? It's not at all. And so although the German people may not want this, and I don't think they do want it, there are definitely people high up in the Defense Department, in the German government, that are planning for this and that are right at the forefront of making this happen.
Yeah, it is just so fascinating. I remember as long ago as 10 years ago hearing like chief European Union leaders talk about how we need a European Union army and we need to make this apparatus and get nations to join, and then nothing ever happens and they can't get the political well together to just, you know, almost kind of coming in through the back door now and just building it bottom up to where it's not actually Germany joining a European Union army. It's just the rest of Europe joining the actual German army.
Well, you know, also, Richard, you make the point that the German people don't seem to want this, but you have to wonder how strong that opposition is really going to be in the climate that you see today with the kind of threats that they're facing and the sort of popular uprising, joining political parties that tend to be more anti-immigrant and have more of an aggressive posture towards some of these threats that Europe is facing. It seems like there definitely would be more support than there would have been, say, 5 years ago for this type of thing.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I've got quite a scary article. We talked about it on the program, but coming up on the Trumpet website sometime over the next week or so about just the rising threat of nuclear terrorism. That is a very, very real threat. And you've got experts saying, well, that they're surprised that some form of nuclear terrorist attack in the form of a dirty bomb hasn't happened already. So you see some of those things start to hit Germany. Very, very quickly, that public opinion could turn around. and then the leaders already have the structures in place to build that European army. And so you could see things turning around fast.
Well, thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review. This past week, President Obama was asked what he considered his worst mistake. And his response wasn't the fact that he had intervened in Libya. It was, he said, probably failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. This is not a man who will admit a mistake. Libya is now a wreck. And to talk about some of the ramifications of this, especially for Europe, we're going to go back to Brent Nachtigall in Jerusalem.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting to just see the timing of Mr. Obama's comments, especially looking at the amount of refugees that are amassing inside Libya right now, awaiting to get onto or waiting to be smuggled across to Malta or Sicily to get to Italy and then venture up towards the EU. The European Council President Donald Tusk, he warned on Wednesday that there is an alarming amount of would-be migrants that are ready to come up through this southern route. Now, the migrant crisis still exists. Obviously, there's a lot of migrants inside Europe, but Europe did do a deal with the Turkish leader Erdogan earlier on this year, the dirty deal, as it's been said. But it looks like the migrants have stopped coming through from Turkey across to Greece because of that strongman there. Well, the United States and Europe, they got rid of the strongman in Libya in 2011. They booted, well, just bombed, really, Muammar Gaddafi out of leadership there. And if for the past 4 or 5 years, you haven't had a stable government, you've got rivaling warring factions, you've got 6,000 ISIS fighters on the coast, it's said, of Libya. And now that the refugees can't get across into Europe from Turkey, they're starting to move through this southern route again to the tune of possibly 350,000. That's what the UN estimates for this year. 350,000 more migrants coming from the south.
So President Obama said that if he felt like there was a specific mistake he made, this might have been a couple of weeks ago, but he said that he just felt like he overestimated Europe's vested interest in the outcome in Libya, and like that was basically the gist of the crux of the problem was that Europe wasn't taking enough responsibility for this, but it appears that Europe's failure to take responsibility is now coming home to roost.
Yeah, he did slap in the face a couple of his European allies with that comment. But honestly, I don't necessarily agree with President Obama all the time. But in this case, I do. I would have expected the Europeans to have a little more vested interest to not creating a horrible, horrible state in Libya, because it was going to come back on them. Where are these people going to go? Obviously, they're going to come across and try and get to Italy, to Malta, to get to the EU. That was the obvious thing. But it has taken a lot to get Europe mobilized to do something, especially in Libya. I mean, it does look like they're going to move that way. There's a number of European objectives, European forces that claim that they're planning on going down to Libya to stabilize things. So maybe that'll happen soon. But I tend to agree with Mr. Obama on that one.
Possibly a Trumpet Hour first. Thanks for that story. This is a Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll conclude with a final bit about space cooperation between two nations. We've been expecting this from, in a sense, to tell us about this. We'll turn back to Andrew.
Yes, well, I certainly get to cover a lot of territory as the Asian news analysis for the Trumpet. Last week, we headed up to the North Pole, so now we're venturing out into outer space. It's last week, the deputy administrator of the Chinese National Space Agency was in India for a conference on Asian space cooperation. And they announced that China and India will be cooperating on a new satellite system similar to GPS that will make both China and India less dependent on U.S. space technology. This is quite a big change, is that for most of the 21st century, what little we've had of it so far, China and India have been rivals in this regard, being in a space race with each other. And now they're announcing that China and India, and even actually all the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are going to be working on their own space alliance.
Definitely fits the narrative that we've been expecting with this coalescing Asian alliance and India joining that. We actually just released a new version of the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet. You can find that on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. There's a new chapter in that booklet about India and what it may contribute to this Asian alliance. We thank you for that, Andrew. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. And if you go there, you can get a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we discuss on this program are in this free report that you can receive in your email inbox each week. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming right up.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Robert.
Well, this week, Peabody Energy, that's the largest, most probably the most storied coal company in U.S. history, announced that it was filing for bankruptcy. This is a company that provides 10% of U.S. electricity. Or it provides the fuel for 10% of America's electricity. This company survived the Great Depression, stock market crashes, the world wars, and yet now it is gone. Its shares are worth pennies. They had a lot of causes that they blamed, but probably the big one that got the least amount of attention was this company's debt. And this company had billions of dollars of debt, and when coal prices fell, it can no longer make the payments, despite the fact that every single one of its mines was so profitable, but they weren't making enough profit to pay the debt back. So the death of one of America's most important coal companies.
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
A German comedian has got Angela Merkel into a lot of trouble. One comedy channel in Germany wrote a pretty catchy song about Turkish President Erdogan, and that caused a diplomatic incident. Then another comedian came along and wrote a poem that is very insulting to the president. Turkey is demanding that Germany put him on trial for violating an obscure German law, making it illegal to violate a head of state. And so Merkel has to choose now between her new best friend for solving the migrant crisis or supporting free speech within Germany. And just the fact that she's facing this choice is adding to her unpopularity. Spiegel wrote this week, it doesn't matter how the chancellor ultimately decides, she has already lost. And a chancellor whose decisions no longer matter has forfeited her power.
All right, thanks for that, Richard. We'll go now to Brent.
Well, we were talking earlier about Putin establishing his Praetorian Guard. Well, Iran already has one, and the head of that Praetorian Guard for the supreme leader is Quds Force leader Qassem Soleimani. Now, he is up visiting with Putin as we speak in Moscow, breaking UN Security Council resolutions because he's not allowed to travel. What they're talking about, we're unsure, but the last time that he ventured up there, a couple months later, we had Russia's armed force coming down into Syria. So we'll see what they're discussing, and maybe there'll be some more of Putin's adventurism coming out of this meeting.
All right, thanks, Brent. Now over to Andrew.
Yeah, United States Secretary of State John Kerry became the highest-ranking government official in United States history to visit the Hiroshima Peace Park Memorial in Japan. He, of course, avoided actually apologizing to the Japanese for the Hiroshima nuclear strike in World War II, but used the two-day used the visit as a stage for a two-day summit he attended, encouraging nuclear disarmament across the globe.
Very interesting. Now over to Robert.
Well, new research from Australian scientists say that sugar addiction should be treated as a form of drug abuse. Researchers from the Queensland University of Technology say that excessive sugar consumption affects the brain in a very similar way to cocaine or morphine. Apparently, it causes dopamine levels to surge, and over time that causes the brain's natural dopamine levels to drop off. So whenever you stop eating the sugar, you start getting that feeling of depression. And over time, you require greater and greater amounts of sugar to get the same dopamine hit. And they say cutting sugar can be as difficult as quitting certain illegal drugs.
Mm. All right, we'll conclude with Richard.
Pirates are taking over Iceland. Iceland's government has been forced out by the scandal around the Panama Papers. And in the wake of the scandal, a political party called the Pirate Party is polling at 40%, 4-0. This began as a pretty nerdy kind of anti-copyright movement. They've kind of expanded now into being about direct democracy, and they do a lot of their decisions via online polls. But that such a new and formerly very fringe party is on the brink of becoming the governing party is a real sign of the wave of discontent that's sweeping over Iceland and indeed all of Europe.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription. Now, get control of yourselves, gentlemen. To our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be on the show.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of John Stuart Mill. War is an ugly thing, but not the ugliest of things. The decayed and degraded state of moral and patriotic feeling, which thinks that nothing is worth war, is much worse. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.